What do you want out of life? There are infinite possible answers to this question, but there's really only one answer that's right for you. Figuring out your life's goal can truly be the work of a lifetime. But if you can ask yourself the question now, you increase your chances of achieving your life's true desire. To help you find your answer, listen to these five big ideas from Life Worth Living, A Guide to What Matters Most by Miroslav Volf, Matt Crossman, and Ryan McAnally-Linz. Miroslav, Matt, and Ryan teach the most in-demand course in Yale College's humanities program, Life Worth Living, which is the inspiration for the book. Here they are to share five of their key insights.
Hi, I'm Miroslav Volf.
I'm Matt Crossman.
And I'm Ryan McAnally-Linz. We work together at the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, and we wrote Life Worth Living, A Guide to What Matters Most, to help people like you wrestle with the most important questions of our lives. It's a book about meaning and purpose, values and principles, what it means to live well, and how to face death. Today, we're going to share five of the key insights from the book with you.
The first insight, and this can be a hard one to hear, is that not everything you want is worth wanting. This could take a minute to explain, but hear me out. I want to walk us through a few different questions we tend to ask ourselves about our lives, if and when we pause to do so. All of us spend a bunch of our time just doing what we do without thinking too much about it. And that's fine. Habits and routine and flow can be great. But sometimes it's important to stop and ask questions. When we do, often our first question has to do with effectiveness. How can we get better at getting what we're after? And again, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with efficiency per se. But efficiency is what we call ends agnostic. A super efficient way of getting something you hate is really different from a super efficient way of getting what you want. But they're both super efficient. The difference isn't one of efficiency, but of outcome. It doesn't do much good to get more of what we're after if what we're after isn't really what we want. And that points to a question that goes deeper than strategy and takes us to the level of self-reflection. What do we really want? Does professional success, for example, really matter to you as much as you think? Or might your deeper desire be for something else? More and better time with family and friends, or space for artistic creativity, and so on. Do you actually want to be well known? Or might you really desire to be known well? Getting to the heart of these things can take serious work, and so this might seem like bedrock, as deep as it gets. I mean, what's deeper than our deepest desires? It might seem like we simply can't ask a more fundamental question. But we can, and we should. The deeper question, the question that can truly change our lives, ground us, and give us direction, is not, what do I really want? It's, what is really worth wanting? This is one way of putting the most important question of our lives, what in the book we just call the capital Q question. We can formulate the question in a ton of different ways. What is a good life? What makes life worth living? What does it mean to flourish? And so on. And they all involve the issue of worth. And they all point to the uncomfortable possibility that the desires we happen to have could be profoundly misaligned, that they might be leading us astray into lives that are less significant, less good than they could be.
That can be a scary thought, especially when we look around and see that people, sensible, well-meaning, incredibly smart people, seem to answer the question differently. This brings us to the second insight. We need to lean into disagreement. It can be tempting to convince ourselves that deep down, everyone actually agrees about what matters most. That would be convenient. It would help us feel confident that we've gotten the answer right. But the great religious thinkers and philosophers have not, in fact, agreed about what it means to flourish as a human being. The Buddha saw many things differently than Plato did. James Baldwin has a profoundly different vision of life from John Locke. Try as we might, we can't peel away the husk of their thought to find some common kernel. The same is true of us ordinary folks. For example, some of us passionately believe that it's almost always okay to put family first. Others of us suspect that putting family first leads to unfair societal outcomes, and families should often sacrifice for the greater good. These aren't two ways of saying the same thing. There's a real disagreement here, an important one. We need to resist the temptation to brush aside these deep disagreements, and we need to resist the temptation to look for a common core. This is important for two reasons. First, pretending there's agreement where there is not is simply dishonest. Second, hiding our head in the sand doesn't actually do us any good. It shuts us off from the possibility of really learning from others. Sometimes facing disagreement will help us see that we haven't thought things through very well, or that we missed an important value by focusing too narrowly. Other times, opposing views will sharpen our own views and leave us with a better appreciation for our own ideals and a stronger commitment to them. So hard as it can be, it's incredibly valuable to face up to our real, serious disagreements with one another about what matters most and why. Don't try to address the most important question of your life with your eyes closed.
Insight number three is this. You probably can't tackle the big question all at once. I have two kids. When the older of the two was 6 years old, she was starting to really get the hang of reading. She was cruising through the little beginner books that she had started with, your Very Hungry Caterpillars and Goodnight Moons. One day, she decided that she was going to read BJ Novak's amazing The Book with No Pictures to her 3-year-old little brother. She was going to be the one who said all the silly things and made him laugh. It was going to be awesome. Everything went great, almost all the way through. She handled the phrase robot monkey with confidence. She belted out the silly sounds with gusto. But then, right toward the end, she got to the word preposterous, and she came up short. To her eyes, this was just an impossibly long string of meaningless letters. What did we do? Well, we broke it down into manageable pieces. Pre-pa-ster-us. That she can handle. When you're trying to figure out what matters most in life, a similar strategy is called for. Instead of taking it all at once, break it down into more manageable chunks. Smaller questions that are still, let's be honest, pretty big, but that at least give you some handholds. This is what we do in the book. We walk through questions like who we're responsible to, how a good life should feel, how to live with suffering that we can't get rid of, and so on. It's still a big task, but at least there's a path through the forest.
As helpful as it is to break the big question down into somewhat more manageable bites, we need a fourth insight, or else our vision of a life worth living will crumble into incoherence. We need to recognize that the good life is not a buffet. Put another way, our answers to all the smaller sub-questions need to fit together. Something like the ingredients of a good recipe go together and complement each other. Whoever you answer to, if you really believe you're responsible to them for how you shape your life, they will need to have a say about how you think a good life feels, what you ought to do about suffering you can't avoid, and other questions like these. That's just part of what it means to understand ourselves as responsible to someone in that way. Similarly, if you're convinced that suffering has a productive role to play in even the best of lives, that will have to shape what you must say about how the good life feels. The answers to each question mold and influence each other. Otherwise, our vision of a good life winds up at war with itself, pulling us in different directions at the same time. Consequently, as much as we might wish we could, we can't shop independently for answers to different sub-questions and then throw them together into a vision of life. Two ingredients, peanut butter and pickle relish, for instance, can each be wonderful on its own, but nearly impossible to fit together in a good recipe. Similarly, if we love what medieval Christian theologian Julian of Norwich has to say about one thing, and what modern Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh has to say about another, we can just assume the two pieces will fit together. Each of these thinkers has a rich, coherent vision of the good life. They offer answers to all the different questions we need to answer for ourselves, and their answers fit together. We can't borrow pieces of what they have to say without thinking seriously to make sure that the pieces we've borrowed actually fit together.
Insight number five. You will botch it. You will fail to live up to your own standards. No matter how well you've thought out what it means to live well, your actual living will fall short of your ideals. Yeah, your failures might not be catastrophic. Little lies here, tiny broken promises there, a string of small compromises that pull you slowly away from your purpose. Your failures might be totally unspectacular, but they will be real and they will matter. I think of a time years ago when I botched it bad. Money was tight, and to make matters worse, I was about to get married. Weddings aren't cheap. In the middle of these money worries, my paycheck one week was double what it normally was, what it should have been. I convinced myself not to make any noise about it, you know, bank error in my favor or whatnot. But it all came to a head when my boss asked me, "Hey, do you notice anything abnormal in your paycheck?" I stammered and shook my head. My boss tried again. "Are you sure? It looked like maybe you got paid double last week." I squirmed a bit more, but held my ground. I swear you could see his face drop the moment he gave up on me coming clean. "Well," he sighed, "congratulations on your wedding. I wanted to give you a gift." I had tried to steal my wedding present. The fact that we will fail to live up to our own standards hurts, but it's a fact. And so we need to face it, which means we need to think well about how to respond when we do fail. First, we need to be willing to recognize our failures. Denial might be a good strategy for politicians looking to hang on to their jobs, but it's not a good one for us as we're seeking to live our lives well. Second, we need an approach that goes deeper than just trying to do better. We need to identify the resources that will help us do better. Because when it comes to seeking lives that are truly worthy of our shared humanity, we need all the help we can get.
So that's five key insights from Life Worth Living, A Guide to What Matters Most. To review, 1, not everything you want is worth wanting. 2, lean into disagreement. 3, you can't tackle the big question all at once. 4, the good life is not a buffet. And 5, you will botch it.
Thank you to the Next Big Idea Club for giving us the opportunity to share these insights. We hope you'll pick up a copy of the book. And you can also get in touch with us at our website, lifeworthlivingbook.com.
Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you. That was 5 big ideas from Life Worth Living, A Guide to What Matters Most by Miroslav Volf, Matt Crossman, and Ryan McAnally-Linz. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.